Welcome to the next edition to our speaker series over here with the Pateka Wealth Management Group. This is John Pateka Jr. and as always accompanied with our senior member of the team, John Pateka Sr. And our guest this month is Eric Potiker. And Eric has covered healthcare as an analyst and portfolio manager since 2002. He previously worked at a multi-billion dollar long short fund, JL Advisors and Karsh Capital Management as the healthcare sector head. Eric has also covered the healthcare sector broadly, including pharmaceuticals, biotech companies, as well as healthcare services and medical device companies. He uses a deep fundamental research approach to stock picking in order to find attractive growth and value opportunities that are out there. Eric received a BA from Dartmouth and an MBA from University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. So, Eric, welcome to the call.
Thanks, John. Great to be with you again.
Thanks again, Eric. Let's get right to it. There's several issues that are driving the healthcare industry now. Tariffs, China, drug pricing laws, and the other issues on drug pricing and, you know, federal spending on healthcare, the big, beautiful bill. So why don't I stop there and let you address some of those things? I know I've read some of your papers on them, and I'm anxious to let our clients see this. So I'll try to touch on that.
Absolutely. And in the beginning of the year, CIO upgraded healthcare to attractive. And the view was really driven by where we saw the sector valued relative to the market and what we've seen really, frankly, over multiple decades, really about policy fear cycles. And what we saw, you know, post-election and through the beginning of the year was heightened fear about U.S. government policy on healthcare. And frankly, those reminded us a lot of what the market saw in the early 90s with Hillary Care and in the 2009-10 timeframe with what became Obamacare and other periods where the market becomes particularly worried about healthcare policy and what that could do to growth and profit margins among global healthcare companies because the U.S. is such an important market and regulation and legislation can impact the profit margins of those healthcare companies. So what we saw was a cycle of growing fear that we thought was really trading, causing the sector to trade at too much of a discount. And underlying that view was my view that we've seen these cycles before. It is frankly quite difficult to change the structure of the healthcare industry in the United States, as we've seen through those other periods of uncertainty. And I also just didn't think healthcare was going to be a priority for the incoming Trump administration. So that was the thesis behind our upgrade. I think that tended to work out really until tariffs and then even more recently, focus on U.S. drug pricing came back into focus in and from this administration. And we've seen sort of a resurgence of fear and frankly, even more fear than we had back in January. And the sector is outperforming and performing well on an absolute basis has really struggled over the last 2 months. And I think we're in the same spot though, frankly, from a risk reward standpoint as we were in January of this year, which is a lot of fear and the likelihood that there's going to be significant change remains quite low. The issue is right now we're at that sort of period where there is very little visibility on what is going to happen with both pharmaceutical tariffs and drug pricing in terms of what this administration and this Congress will do. And with that uncertainty, and frankly, it's uncertainty that seems more, the healthcare seems more beset by that uncertainty than other sectors because the tariff concerns that other sectors had after April 2nd have subsided as the administration has backed off a lot of the most aggressive tariff rates and proposals that it had for various countries. And yet there has been no clarity on healthcare. There is an ongoing, or at least on pharmaceuticals, there's an ongoing investigation, a Section 232 investigation of potential national security issues around the pharmaceutical supply chain and around pharmaceutical trade practices that we expect will result in some kind of pharmaceutical industry tariffs, but we don't know what they'll be. We don't know the rate. We don't know what they'll be applied to. And we also don't know ultimately what the impact will be. So that uncertainty really is one paralyzing force that I think impacts investors' appetite towards pharmaceuticals. And as a result, we can talk about sort of the nuance between the different or among the different sectors in healthcare, but pharmaceuticals are still the largest percentage of market cap for healthcare. They're still what most investors think about when they think about healthcare. And they're really the sector that's under the most, under the largest cloud right now as it relates to tariffs. And then even putting tariffs aside for a moment, the other issue that emerged, I'd say, in early May is Trump again looking to pursue something called most favored nation drug pricing, where the U.S. drug price would be set according to the lowest price available in other developed countries. And that's something he pursued during his first term. It ended up being pursued through a regulatory pathway that's actually quite narrow and ended up being struck down in the courts and didn't amount to much of anything. And then really the thought was he really wasn't going to pursue that again this term, but then he did. And it's clearly an issue he finds important enough to continue to try to create policy on. So, you know, of the two issues, and I think ultimately these two issues are related from a political and practical standpoint. I'll get to that. But I think of the two, drug pricing is the bigger threat. The pharmaceutical tariffs, you know, all the drug companies, first of all, they had a lot of time to prepare for potential tariffs. And all of them understand that part of the goal of threatening tariffs is to get U.S. drug manufacturers to bring more of their manufacturing back to the United States. And most, many of them, to the tune of about $200 billion, have made commitments to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. over the next, call it, 5 to 7 years. And I think over time, they have the scale and they already have the geographical manufacturing capabilities to make whatever products are consumed in the United States to actually produce them in the United States, thus avoiding or at least significantly mitigating the impact from any tariffs. And, you know, they would be making products for Europe and Europe. You know, they already do that for various reasons. Now they actually make a lot of product outside the U.S. and then import it into the U.S. really for tax purposes. To cut to the bottom line, I think from a tariff perspective, the pharmaceutical companies can manage the impact over the long run. And over the short run, they've all been building inventory like crazy as they prepare for the eventual tariff acts to fall. The more product that they will have imported and keep on their shelves, the greater the ability to delay the impact of any tariffs because it will have already imported much of that product. And I think most of them have imported sufficient product for the rest of this year to avoid any kind of earnings impact from tariffs. So the real question is, how much would the tariff impact be between the inventory being worked down at some point, probably early next year, and the eventual shifting of the manufacturing footprint such that importing of drugs into the U.S. would be much smaller? Probably be a couple of years of exposure where they would be paying tariffs, and that would probably fall in 2026 and 2027. Now, I think the market can live with that, because it would view the earnings hit as being relatively short term. Drug pricing is the bigger concern because we do have higher prices in the U.S. They're not as high relative to Europe as one reads in the headlines, because drug companies significantly discount and rebate off of their list prices when they sell to U.S. insurers and to the U.S. government. So the net pricing in the U.S., not 3 or 4 times the pricing in Europe, it's probably 30 to 50% higher, which is still significantly higher. And it'll vary by drug and it'll vary by country. But the pressure on pricing, if there were to be either a law or a rule or regulation that would be able to enforce lower pricing in the U.S., would be significant and would be harder for pharma to mitigate that impact. So with those two issues outstanding, right now you just see weakness in the sector because there's not a lot of appetite for investors to step into that uncertainty. And there's no clear time frame for the resolution of either tariffs on pharma or the drug pricing dynamic. What I will say is I think that from a drug pricing standpoint, it does not look like the administration will be able to get drug pricing into the current bill that's being negotiated in the Senate. The one big beautiful bill, John, that you've alluded to. The administration tried to get the House to include drug pricing, and the Republican leadership did not want to do that. And it, despite rumblings from certain senators who tried to put something in the Senate version, at least the version that came out of the Senate Finance Committee did not have anything on drug pricing. And the reality is drug pricing is very complicated, controversial. Putting drug pricing provisions into what's already a complicated and controversial bill, I think, would just complicate it more and reduce the odds of passage. I don't think we're going to see legislation. And really, the only way to change drug pricing is through legislation. The regulatory path, again, would be very narrow and would have very little impact. But I think until the market can see that and be comfortable that there is not going to be legislation impacting drug pricing and that the regulatory path is in fact quite narrow, I think the market's going to be cautious and remain cautious on pharmaceutical valuations and stocks for now. And then the last thing I'll say is it is quite possible that in the minds of this administration, tariffs are tied to drug pricing and that they do have the ability to impose tariffs. And they could impose very large tariffs if they wanted to be punitive or if they wanted to exert negotiating leverage on the pharmaceutical industry. It is quite possible that what the administration is looking for and what pharma might agree to in some way is a grand bargain that ties tariffs to drug pricing with some kind of a concession that the industry would make on drug pricing. Unclear what that might be, but there is talk that there's a grand bargain in the works that would tie all of this together. Frankly, I think that would be quite positive because whatever the industry would give up would probably be temporary, somewhat manageable from an earnings standpoint, and would remove the multiple clouds of uncertainty that both tariffs and drug pricing currently play or currently pose to the industry. But until we see some of this materialize over the next few months, the uncertainty, frankly, is enough to keep investors away. And that's why the pharmaceutical sector and then the healthcare sector more broadly is trading at the discount it's trading at. So long-winded way of getting at those two issues without a lot of clarity as to when we're going to have real visibility on the outcome. But I think over the next 3 months, we will know more and there will be more clarity. And that should result in healthcare trading better, because right now the uncertainty, I think, is really paralyzing investors when it comes to healthcare.
Yeah. Thanks, Derek. Take a minute on this for me. You know, the main argument against price controls is the effect it has on research and development. Maybe you can just give me your own personal thoughts on and clarify for us what effect price controls would have.
Yeah, that's a good question. Price controls in the U.S. would reduce profitability, all else equal, for pharmaceutical companies. Reduced profitability is going to result in something else being done to their cost structure to offset the fact that they no longer can price with, in a free market. Those areas, given where they spend their money, the two big areas are research and development on new drugs and sales and marketing on their existing drugs. My guess is both would get cut. The vehicle for those cuts would probably be some form of consolidation, because it is still a relatively fragmented industry and there is a lot of duplicative R&D spend among the companies. And one of the ways to reduce that duplicative spend would be to merge. So I think you would see a lot of mergers. I think so ultimately you would have less R&D spending and that would impact innovation. Just, if you throw fewer dollars into new drugs, you're going to have fewer new drugs coming out of the other end. But I also think there are other ways that they could avoid spending money. I don't think it would be a national catastrophe if we didn't have to watch 5 minutes of drug advertisement on just about every sporting event and national news program. So I think there are areas where they could save money. That's a bit of an arms race where no one company wants to disarm when it comes to DTC advertising. But I think as an industry, if they all had to disarm, they'd all probably be okay with that. To your question, I also think R&D spend would come down in the aggregate, and that would impact innovation.
Well, then where's the growth going to come from in going forward? Obviously, you have the obesity and diabetes stuff, and you got the cancer, you got the aging. I mean, that's a lot to pack in.
Yeah.
But where do I find the growth?
Well, I think those areas will still be areas of growth because there's still a lot of unmet need. I think the question is, will there be enough new products to drive as much growth as the industry has seen? And that's a fair question. But I think one can still have growth in what would be a more efficient industry if you had consolidation, because I think there is a lot of duplicative research and development spend that could go away. And there is still significant unmet need on obesity, and those drugs, frankly, at least the first two are out in the market, and there will be more coming. And while there is lots of promotion, frankly, people know about those drugs even without the promotion. So I think that segment of the market can continue to grow. I think the cancer oncology will continue to grow. The innovation is more incremental, and you could certainly see some slowdown in certain areas of oncology that would reduce the innovation. But I think as we still have baby boom demographic aging into a period where it consumes more healthcare because it has greater healthcare needs. And, we obviously have a longevity transformational investment opportunity theme that captures the notion that people, not only is the existing baby boom demographic living longer, but other generations should live longer as well, resulting in more people living into their 80s, 90s, and 100s. And as people live into those latter decades, they just need more, they need more care. They need replacement parts. And so that theme, I think, will continue to be a growth theme, even if you see pricing and other sort of ways of rationing care. And look, ultimately, you know, society has to end up paying for people who live longer and have greater healthcare needs. And one of the ways society is going to do that is by rationing and finding other ways to ration. So that will result in some pressure on price, but I think the volume will more than make up for that. And with obesity specifically, prices for these obesity drugs are coming down. I met with one of the CEOs a couple months ago. They'll readily admit that they expect pricing to come down by somewhere between mid and high single digits a year. And they're perfectly happy with that as long as it means they can get access to more patients, because the volume will more than make up for the price concessions. So I think those sectors will continue to have those segments and those therapeutic areas will continue to drive significant growth. However, if we do see pressure, if the pressure to pay for that growth from governments results in less money going into R&D and fewer new products, that will limit the growth in the future. But I still think there's enough other forces to drive growth that we'll still have, you know, a reasonable amount of growth. It's just a question of how much the government decides to strangle the golden goose in terms of the innovation.
You mentioned medical device. I'm just curious how the different, I don't know, spare parts have been priced over time. I know the knees and the hips are almost a commodity now versus the cardiovascular. Can you speak for a minute on the different med device areas?
Yeah. So like for like products, so the same hip, the same knee, you basically have flat pricing, and there isn't a lot of pricing power. But a new version of a knee, a new, you know, the new surgical device that goes with a knee or a hip implant does get an added price bump. So there is pricing that comes with mix as newer products come to market. You know, cardiology, you're right there. There's a little bit more pricing power, but that also is driven by newer products coming to market. You see that, you know, in the case of ablation, for example, where traditionally ablation to deal with an arrhythmic heart would be either through freezing or through burning tissue. New area or new technology where it's called pulse field ablation is basically a safer, easier way to create that ablation, treat the patient, and that's coming at a premium price because it's a better technology. You, in effect, get higher pricing as newer, better versions of a product come to market. And that's the way the device industry has been able to, one of the ways they've been able to grow. And, you know, interestingly, the device industry as a whole is really not subject to the kind of policy risk that the pharmaceutical industry has found itself in. And the device industry also doesn't have the same kind of exposure to cheap generics the way the pharmaceutical industry does. So it's become, from an investor standpoint, just an easier market to invest in from, you know, because the growth is easier to predict, less likely to be limited either by government policy or by the emergence of very cheap alternatives. And you can see in the marketplace where the medical device sector, subsector, has actually done quite well and is trading at near peak valuations as opposed to pharma. And part of the reason right now is there's no pricing issue. And right now there's really no tariff issue for the medical, or very little in the way of tariff exposure to the medical device companies. So the green is just much easier places to invest. And we like a number of the medical device companies, although we are watching just the relative gap in valuation between medical devices and pharma, and that is starting to look extreme. So you could see some positioning unwind if the pricing risks and the tariff risks for pharma become a little less severe. You could see some rotation back into pharma and out of medical devices. But longer term, I think the medical device sector is very well positioned just from an end market growth standpoint.
Eric, litigation always has been a major issue, of course. Can you touch on the J&J court cases? That seems to be the biggest one going on out there.
Yeah, and that one has continued to be a drag on mainly the company, but there are, you know, other litigations pop up and become become liabilities for these companies. With that one in particular, so J&J tried, I think, three times to structure a subsidiary bankruptcy into which all of the talc claims would roll and thus cap their liability. And I think after the most recent court rejection of that structure, J&J has just decided to go back to fighting these cases in court. They actually have a very good track record over the last few years of winning in most of these cases in court and having some of the large jury awards knocked out or reduced dramatically. And ironically, when J&J lost the last court case for its bankruptcy structure, not an actual talc case, but the bankruptcy structure that J&J was again proposing to use in order to put a cap on the talc liabilities, it actually then lowered the reserve that it had put in place for that bankruptcy settlement and actually put capital back onto its balance sheet by reducing that reserve to the tune of multiple billions of dollars, because it doesn't think it's going to end up losing and paying as much to plaintiffs fighting these cases one by one, if you will, in court, than if it had settled in bankruptcy. So from a financial standpoint, it actually was better for J&J. The problem is the ongoing uncertainty about these cases, because there are a lot of them. Many of them are at least initially in plaintiff-friendly venues. Large jury awards have happened in the past and will no doubt happen again, despite J&J's recent track record of winning in a lot of lower court cases. The overhang continues, and I hope most investors had, was that a bankruptcy subsidiary settlement would cap the liability and remove the issue so investors didn't have to worry about an open-ended liability. I think over time, if the J&J's recent track record continues, that investors will over time worry about this less. But it is, it is an annoying factor. And there are many investors who just either won't or can't get in front of these kinds of open-ended liabilities, whether it's for financial reasons or whether it's for ESG reasons. So it is a bit of an albatross on J&J.
Just have time for a couple more. I'd like you to comment on how you think AI might affect the industry.
Yeah, so it really depends on which part of the industry we're talking about. I think if we look at the services part of the industry, I think the most powerful places for AI are really a diagnostic, where it's already being used to scan images and detect cancers. That's not new. That's been the case for a few years. But I think the power of AI will enable that process to be even stronger and better in terms of the effectiveness of diagnosing cancers, never completely without human interface, but more and more human interface coming later in the process. Certainly see a number of the insurance companies using AI to better predict where their health costs are spiking and how best to manage those health costs. You're seeing it on a micro level where, certain conditions that are broad spectrum conditions, think about diagnosing kids with ADHD or with, kids on the autism spectrum, where depending on where a patient is on that spectrum, the treatment could be very different. And the best way to analyze those segments of a spectrum disorder is with a lot of data to figure out exactly what the patient type is and what the right treatment modality is. Those are areas where I think AI can be very helpful at bringing targeted cures to the right subset of patients. If you move instead over to things like drug development, I'm a little less optimistic that AI is dramatically going to change drug development. I think it certainly helps in the screening of compounds, proteins, chemicals, and targets in the body. Big pharma companies have been using machine learning, for years already. So I don't know how much the things like ChatGPT and other forms of AI are really going to change the efficiency with which pharma companies are screening molecules before they go into animals and then into humans. And I don't think the need for clinical trials, i.e. studying experimental medicines in humans, is going to change. I don't think the FDA and other regulators are suddenly going to, or even gradually over time, going to tell companies they don't need to conduct human clinical trials. And that's really where you see drugs work or not work. That's really where the large expense is in developing drugs. So if you think about the funnel, I can certainly see the width of the funnel at the beginning of the drug development process getting wider and being steeper. But I think then the narrower part of that funnel, which is the clinical trials that are still time consuming, I don't think AI is going to change that as much. I think it will. I think on the margin, it can help make clinical trials more efficient by putting the right patients in trials and helping make sure that those patients stay in trials, because patients dropping out of trials slows and reduces the odds of success in many cases for clinical trials. So I think it can help, but I think it's more on the margin and more incremental. But I don't expect a sudden dramatic change in the effectiveness of drugs that are being studied just because AI is being used either in the discovery process or even in the clinical trial process.
Well, finally, given all this information, where can our clients make money going forward?
Yeah, so I think right now, I continue to think the fear cycle in healthcare is peaking, and that over the next 3 to 6 months, we'll see some reduction, and we'll see greater visibility on regulation and legislation, and I think reduced perception of risk. The healthcare system is going to be changed dramatically, and I think that will lead to some closing of the valuation gap between healthcare and the rest of the market. I think we're going to see areas where there is obvious, strong, and durable growth continuing. I'd say metabolic disease in particular stands out. So that's obesity, diabetes, as well as some other conditions that then are downstream from obesity and or diabetes. I think those continue to be strong areas. We like both some of the companies that have pharmaceutical, I don't want to say cures, but treatments for things like diabetes and obesity, as well as the medical device companies in particular that are focused in the diabetes market, continuous glucose monitoring in particular, which I think is still relatively underpenetrated into the diabetic population and is a relatively cost-effective way to help diabetics manage their glucose levels and thus avoid the acute episodes that many diabetic patients have to confront over time.
Hey, Eric, John Junior here, and we're getting close to the end of our call here. And as we wrap up, just wanted to see if you had any final thoughts that we might have not discussed yet in our call that you feel we should be talking about as far as the healthcare sector.
Well, I think we captured most of the issues that are impacting healthcare near term, as well as a lot of the long term opportunities. I think one area that we didn't touch on that there's still significant unmet need, and where hopefully in the next 6 to 18 months, we'll see data that may open up a greater benefit for patients suffering from Alzheimer's. Right now, we have two disease-modifying drugs on the market that really, in the clinical studies, really didn't do a lot for the patients, but I think have the potential in earlier stage patients, pre-symptomatic patients, who already have some of the disease cascade from Alzheimer's starting to show up in their diagnostic testing. We may see data over the next probably 12 to 18 months that might show if you can identify those patients early enough and treat them early enough, you may actually have a much greater impact on Alzheimer's and on delaying or modifying the course of the disease. Alzheimer's has been a really difficult place to invest for literally the last 2 decades. When I hold out hope, it's with some breath that I'm holding as well, because I've just seen a lot of hopes dashed. But I do think we might, over the next 12 to 18 months, start to see some data that may at least open up a more promising way to both identify patients early and treat them very early in the course of disease, and that would have an impact in preventing disease progression.
Great. Well, we appreciate you coming on our call and spending some time with us, but we really enjoy reading your research reports. And if any of our listeners on this call would like us to send those out to them, feel free to reach out. But, Eric focuses on some of his most preferred companies that he thinks make sense for investment at this time. And so we really appreciate you creating those and sending those out. So keep it up. Thank you again. And that'll be the end of our call. So thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Great talking with you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.